International students pay significant fees. They pay more fees. They contribute a lot more to the economy and to the coffers of universities than domestic students do. And my view is that they should have the same right to welfare support as domestic students. The government has been consistently prepared to take the money of international students, but not to reciprocate that support wherever it's needed.
Staffing. It's all anybody in hospitality is talking about. No one's answering ads. Owners are working crazy hours. Employees are stretched. And from a diner point of view, I can see the difference. Opening hours are reduced. Employees are often harried or obviously inexperienced. So I'm being kind. Menus are shorter. And at the same time, bizarrely, new restaurants keep opening or trying to. This week on Dirty Linen, we're going to examine the huge topic of restaurant staff from many different angles. And today we're talking to an expert on labour markets. Chris Wright is Associate Professor at the University of Sydney Business School. His research focuses on employment relations, that is, the regulation and management of work, as well as labour migration. Chris, welcome.
Thanks, Danny.
Give us an overview of the situation as you see it.
So I guess the hospitality industry for a long time has been beset by some big challenges in recruiting and retaining staff. We see that in a lot of media discussion around this issue. We see that that migrant workers have become a really important part of the solution for hospitality businesses in addressing their workforce needs. And there's also been some challenges around ensuring that workers, particularly migrant workers, are paid appropriately and in accordance with the legal standards. So this is an issue where there's a lot going on. There seem to be some big challenges, both in terms of businesses getting the workers that they need and then also workers ensuring that their conditions are protected.
I mean, let's pull back a bit from the immediate crisis and look at the ways that Australia's immigration system has changed over the decades. And I guess, you know, it's Australia's always relied on immigration, but it's never been perfect. And, you know, I suppose you could point to a couple of major instances of discrimination, let's say Pacific Islanders being forced to work in the Queensland cane fields from the 1860s. There's the infamous White Australia policy, which limited Asian migration from Federation until after World War II. But I guess, you know, despite all the things that haven't been great about it, for a lot of migrants that came to Australia, they did seem to be properly welcomed. It did seem more of an inclusive system with clear pathways to permanent residency upon arrival. I mean, when do you think this started to change?
It started to change in the mid to late 1990s. So, you know, I think particularly that period from around the early 1970s until the mid 1990s, that was a period where, you know, looking at a lot of the research about you know, what constitutes a good migration program, particularly from the point of view of nation building, the Australian migration system between the 70s and the 90s was pretty much as good as you could hope for, in the sense that you know, that was the period after the White Australia policy was finished, so we'd ended having a discriminatory immigration policy. There was provision for both people to come through, you know, skilled and employment routes and also family routes. And I think critically, the people coming to Australia on a visa, they had very easy access to permanent residency. Basically, the system was designed entirely around permanent residency. And they were receiving the same wages and conditions as citizens. So I think that was, and also there was a lot of support in terms of settlement by the government and by also community organisations. So that helped to build a very cohesive and inclusive immigration program. And then from the 1990s, it was a bipartisan initiative. We saw governments, both, you know, Coalition and Labor, move towards temporary visas, first around the temporary skill visa, the 457. originally it was designed for executive and professional staff, and then changed somewhat. And then we saw some changes to the working holiday visa program, which had been in place since the 70s, but it was really a cultural exchange visa, basically focused primarily on allowing people to have a holiday and to work a little bit on the side. But that became much more of a work visa, particularly to geared towards the labour needs of the horticulture sector. And also some changes around student visas as well, which, yeah, again, had been in place since the 50s, since the Colombo Plan, but really increased in a big way from the 1990s. And students had and still do have the right to work, albeit a limited right to work under a student visa. So the 1990s and from then onwards, we see gradual changes to temporary visa programs that make them much more focused on meeting the needs of the labour market. But unlike the earlier period, temporary visa holders often had their rights restricted compared to permanent migrants and permanent residents and citizens.
Mm. I mean, I guess they've never had their rights restricted in the sense that they're supposed to be paid less, but they did have their rights restricted in the sense that they weren't, you know, let's say for the sponsored workers, they weren't allowed to move from employer to employer as they wished. And for the students, they weren't allowed to work as many hours as they wanted. They were restricted to 40 hours a fortnight. Are those the kinds of things that you're talking about?
Yeah. So restrictions on mobility for temporary school visa holders and also for other categories of visas. Which is important, I think, because if someone's right to be in the country is effectively tied to an employer, to their sponsoring employer, that can make them often reluctant to speak up. But also for virtually all categories of temporary visa holders, restrictions on their social rights, their access to welfare support, could contribute to, would often make people more reliant upon paid work, and the instances of people who otherwise may have sought alternative employment but couldn't because they really needed the income. That's a relevant issue to mention as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I suppose that also built up around this influx of international students and the restrictions with them is this whole education industry. And I think whenever I start thinking and talking about this, you realise that there's a whole ecosystem of institutions and regulations that people are sort of unwittingly embedded in, simply by, getting on a plane and coming to Australia.
Yeah, so that's right. I mean, so a whole range of things happened changes happened, I should say, to student visas in the late 1990s. And one of the things that the government did, which I think was really positive at the time, was that they smoothed the pathway from student visas to permanent skill visas. So until about 1999, if somebody was studying in Australia and they wanted to then transition to a skilled visa, they had to first go return to their home country and then reapply. And that was eliminated that barrier. The government at the time recognised that student visa holders have been in Australia for several years, and if they want to continue to live and contribute to the workforce, they should be given the right to do so in a very easy way, in a much easier way. That's an important change, but some of those, it's become harder from what I understand. It's become harder for students to get access to permanent residency after they complete their studies.
Yeah. So, I mean, as I understand it, once students graduate, they can go into a graduate visa for 2 years and they can work with unlimited hours in their field of study or qualification. So there are a lot of people in hospitality on those visas. But, yeah, then I think the pathway from graduate to permanent residency can be pretty tricky, rocky, long and expensive. So, yeah, I guess there is a pathway, but it's not a clear pathway. And I suppose a lot of people would say philosophically, why should there be a pathway? You know, people have chosen to come here to study. You know, they've studied and then off they go.
Well, they might go to another country who's going to capitalize, to put it very crudely, on their investment in their education and skills. So, I mean, I think it's a bit of a waste from Australia's perspective if somebody's been accepted here to study and then that person wants to continue contributing, as a member of the workforce or as a member of society or as a member of the Australian population, and then it's made hard for them. I think that doesn't really make any sense from a range of perspectives. So, I mean, I'm a strong advocate of a big Australia, of one of the perhaps the defining feature of post-invasion Australia is that that we're a nation of immigrants and that we're a workforce of immigrants and that we should be doing everything we can to make the most of that. So, I think those paths. I mean, I generally think that the permanent residency program is the best system because it's the most inclusive system. Many of those inequalities around social rights and barriers to mobility in the workforce don't exist. But temporary visas have a role, and but where they do have a role, I think that there should be a clear pathway to permanent residency for people who want it.
Mm. Well, I mean, like personally, I've celebrated a number of people getting onto that pathway or even getting permanent residency over the past 18 months when they've been in such a perilous situation. So I think, on a macro level, there are lots of other conversations we could have about, what a supportable population and about the environmental considerations that need to be brought to bear on that whole conversation. But let's not make the conversation too enormous right now. So, Chris, the reason that I reached out to you particularly now is because of the rule change around international students and their work rights in relation to the number of hours that they're allowed to work. So until recently, students who were working in hospitality, international students were only allowed to work 40 hours a fortnight. That restriction has now been lifted. So on the face of it, at the urging of industry groups that have pointed out that there's a massive shortfall in staffing and that this would go some way to easing that. Now, your article in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, I'll just read a little quote from it. You said this: "It effectively offers international students up as sacrificial lambs to these employers renowned for exploitation." And then a bit later on you said, "Business claims of labour shortage are met by a government unquestionably increasing the supply of vulnerable temporary migrant labour." Now, I thought this was so interesting, and I get that perspective, but for me it's like when I saw that rule change, I was like, yay, students can piss off those exploitative cash jobs that they've been forced into because actually you can't live on 20 hours a week, and they can go to businesses that are paying them award wages and work as much as they need to put food on the table and pay their rent.
Yeah, I hope you're right. And I think, one thing that we touch upon in the article but probably should have acknowledged further is that 40 hours a fortnight rule was a potential or an actual source of vulnerability. It was an issue in the 7-Eleven case from a few years ago and in other cases of where international students who had exceeded their 40-hour limit, that had been held over them by their employers and used as a kind of essentially a threat to prevent them from reporting their employers. So in that sense, the lifting the 40-hour limit is a good thing. Let me now sort of talk about the reasons why we wrote the article and came to the arguments that we did, ultimately saying that we didn't think it was a good decision. A key one for us, so I mean, as you mentioned, I do a lot of research around employment relations in addition to work on migrant workers. And, one of the key problems in terms of the labour market over the past few years has been the rise in the number of cases of people being underpaid. And Unfortunately, the hospitality industry is a has been the site of some of this underpayment. So my co-author in that piece, Stephen Clibborn, did a survey a few years ago where he found that around 60% of international students living in Sydney were being paid below the minimum wage, and that figure was 80% in restaurants. And there was another study done by some colleagues at UTS and University of New South Wales, Laurie Berg and Bettina Farben-Bloom, who found something very similar, that that around 71% of students, or sorry, temporary visa holders, were being paid in food services, were being paid below $15 an hour. And this is a few years ago, so it was a time when the minimum wage was around $17 an hour. So that was still quite a large portion of people being paid below what they were legally entitled to. So a key issue is the lack of enforcement of essentially those legal minimum standards. And I'm saying it's all parts of hospitality or all parts of the labour market, but it seems there are certainly some businesses who aren't complying, and that's resulting in some pretty serious exploitation. So that's one concern. And the other is that, I mean, on the face of it, the 40-hour limit, yeah, lifting it is a good thing because it does remove that source of vulnerability. But, I mean, looking at what the purpose of that visa is, it is a study visa. And so a condition of that visa is that students are enrolled in full-time study. And Alan Fells, who used to be head of the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission, he was asked by the government a few years ago to lead a task force to investigate some of the problems around temporary migrant workers being exploited. And the task force did consider whether to propose to the government to lift this restriction. And indeed, it did receive evidence that, you know, employers had been coercing students to work beyond that 40 hours a fortnight in order to discourage them from reporting underpayment, but ultimately decided not to because of various things, essentially because of the importance of maintaining the focus of that visa on its primary purpose, to allow students to study. And there was also evidence that it mentioned in its report that students who worked more than 40 hours per fortnight were more likely to fail their coursework and not fulfill that primary purpose. So yes, students need to work. I fully understand that. But really, for the purposes of this visa, work is a secondary purpose. And I think that that needs to maintain the focus. So that's essentially what led us to conclude that it wasn't a particularly, on balance, that it wasn't a policy that we thought was the right one.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I understand that perspective, and, you know, I don't question the research. However, it's quite an idealistic point of view because, I mean, some students come with family money, many don't. Some students that were here and did have family support before the pandemic, you have families that weren't able to sustain that during the pandemic, whether it's, you know, a Turkish student who's, you know, family back home, their currency's been devalued, you know, 10 times, you know, whatever it is, their money's not worth as much as it was, whatever, you know, whatever the particular scenario is, but there's a lot of people in that situation. So I suppose it's saying we want rich students to come here. We don't want to have people who are looking to break the cycle of poverty, perhaps, or, you know, be the first person in their family to go to university, first person in their family to travel overseas. You know, I think you cut yourself off from a lot of those people. And the people that do come here needing to support themselves, the fact is that they actually, I mean, it would be a pretty rare person in Australia that could support themselves on 20 hours work a week. I mean, there would only be a few people who could, let's say, get an hourly rate that would be enough to sustain them on just 20 hours. So the fact is that they go into the black economy where they are more likely to be exploited. So, yeah, I can see the thinking, but I just think in the real world, these people who do come here as adults and who need to be able to manage their workload. I don't know. There's not a very good, clear legal pathway for them.
No, sure. And I completely support and agree with what you say. International students need to be able to support themselves, and work needs to be part of that. But I would suggest some different solutions to that end. I think the first thing is that there's got to be better enforcement of minimum standards, so that if somebody works their 20 hours a week, they're going to get paid as they're entitled to, which those surveys I mentioned before indicate is not happening for most students working. Not working, especially in hospitality, but also in other industries as well. And the other thing is, I think that international students pay significant fees. They pay more fees. They contribute a lot more to the economy and to the coffers of universities than domestic students do. And my view is that they should have the same rights to welfare support as domestic students. They should have rights to income support. They should certainly have had rights to unemployment support and job seeker and job keeper. So the government has been consistently prepared to take the money of international students, but not to reciprocate that support where it's needed. And I think that is a better way of ensuring that students coming here do have the necessary support financially to enable them to complete their studies and to support themselves.
Yeah, look, I really agree with all of that. And I would add to that Medicare. They should absolutely be entitled to Medicare support. It's just the situations that some of those people are in, it's really, really sad. Just like one example, a girl that I know who's being chased by a pathology lab for an $80 blood test, which, for the rest of us would just go on to Medicare. And you just think that just that simple thing, that $80 that is chasing her, and it brings so much stress to a vulnerable person. So that's just one tiny little example. But, Chris, sorry to say, and I'm sure I'm not bringing you this bad news, that in the recent budget, migrants were given a 4-year waiting period to access any income support post-permanent residency. So I don't think the government is ideologically lining up next to you here.
Yeah, I've been saying increasingly loudly over the past few years that there needs to be some major changes to ensure greater equality between people who come here from abroad and people who are here as citizens, generally that those arguments have been made with respect to temporary visas, but now we're starting to see these inequalities creep in terms of permanent residency, and it is so short-sighted. I mean, it is motivated, it seems, simply by wanting to offset some of the spending that is the government's committing to in other areas. But it means that, that people who are coming here, who are making the decision to build a life here as a permanent resident, are not going to have access to the same support, not just in terms of welfare, but also things like, having subsidised childcare. I mean, childcare is incredibly expensive in Australia, it's expensive even for people who have it subsidised by the government. But it's, I know I have friends and colleagues who are on temporary skill visas and other temporary visas, and that makes such a difference, that subsidy, and not having that makes a lot more difficult for them. In some states, the state governments withdraw the subsidies for people, temporary visa holders, and now perhaps even permanent residency visa holders who send their kids to public schools. So they have to provide additional payments. And it is creating inequalities that I think are, firstly, they're unfair, but secondly, they send a signal to people that, well, we're not prepared to reciprocate the trust and the commitment that you're making to the country. And I think that that really undermines the ethos of, you know, Australia as a nation of immigrants. So they're really regrettable decisions, and I hope that the government reconsiders them. Although I'm not optimistic about that.
I agree with you. I think it's, you know, they are looking for financial savings, but you can only make those decisions based on ideology. And the ideology is that, you know, we're us and you're them, and you still are them, and you're not one of us. And, you know, I'm just pulling away the welcome mat. Come here, build a life, spend your money, pay some taxes, but you're not really one of us. And it's just not the Australia that I want to live in. But anyway, okay, Chris, let's just slightly change tack. One of the things that employers say is that Australians don't want to do these jobs in hospitality. The Australians just don't want to work in restaurants, in kitchens. Why is that?
I think it comes down to that if we look at the working conditions in other industries, that hospitality, the conditions are pretty tough. This is kind of seen across a whole range of measures. So, you know, the pay, the average weekly pay for hospitality is, you know, well below the average weekly pay. It's the lowest of all the industries that the Australian Bureau of Statistics reports on. There's a high proportion of employees in hospitality who are employed as casual, around 65% compared to around 25% of employees across the workforce. That's important because, you know, if people are employed as casual, they're less likely to receive things like training. They're less likely to perhaps seek a career in the industry and perhaps, you know, commit to their employer. I guess in also parts of hospitality, I'm sure you know much better than I am, that the hours are very long, you know, the work patterns are really intense. I don't necessarily doubt that some people working in the industry that for employers and managers that they do get frustrated, perhaps like employers in any industry do, perhaps with their staff. But I think in some ways it is a bit of an easy thing for employers to say that the reason they have these problems attracting and retaining staff is because, you know, people are lazy or because they've got poor work ethic. I think that looking as objectively as possible, that, you know, wages are low, working arrangements are insecure, and there's just not as much protection for workers in this industry as there are in other industries.
Can you see any practical changes that might help this situation?
Yeah, I think that, you know, that there's things that maybe individual businesses can do, and there are things that the industry as a whole can do. So, in terms of what, you know, businesses can do, I think that thinking about how, and I know that there are plenty of businesses out there who do these things. So it's not, I don't want to be too blanket in my comments, but we published a paper earlier this year on the restaurant industry with some colleagues here at the University of Sydney, looking at some of the middle to high end restaurants, and it was an industry that people were very passionate working in, and the staff were very excited to be working in those restaurants. But they often got to a point in their lives, often, you know, when their commitments outside of work intensified, perhaps around the time they had families, where they just found it very difficult to manage those responsibilities outside of work with some of the work structures, like the long shifts, the intensity of work. One thing could be to, you know, ensure that, you know, maybe redesigning rosters to allow shorter shifts, perhaps, or ensuring staff are paid properly is a key one. Having, you know, good pathways in place for training. One of the things that's happened in over the past decade or so is it's been a really sharp decline in the number of apprentices and trainees in the food trades. So around 10 years ago, there's about just under 20,000 people who are undergoing food trades training, and that's declined by almost half, or by about over a third at least, to around 12,000. So, I mean, that's really critical for the ability of businesses to be able to address their labour needs, having workers who are trained. So, improving some of the issues around the training system, I think, could also really help.
Yeah, and I guess there was a little bit in the budget around training, which some hospitality operators could look at as useful, but it doesn't address the immediate situation. But I suppose, you know, short-term thinking works pretty well for a while, especially when there's not a pandemic and you can keep propping up an industry by bringing people in from overseas. But I suppose in so many ways this pandemic has exposed the fault lines and issues that we've got in our society. And, yeah, this is just one of them.
Well, I guess no one really saw this coming, and that, this is one of those things. And hospitality isn't the only industry that's been affected by this. I mean, you know, I work for a university. Universities in a very similar situation in terms of relying upon both staff and students from abroad. I think it's just one of those things that's happened. And one thing, I've been doing some interviews over the past couple of years, the past 18 months, with people in hospitality, and including employers and industry representatives. And one of the things that was reported to me was that, again, I'm sure this is not something, I'm not telling you anything new here, Danny, but that in around 2017, 2018, when the government at the time overhauled the old 457 visa and replaced it with a new visa, and under those changes, it became very difficult, for almost impossible, for cooks coming to Australia to transition from a temporary visa to a permanent visa. And it sounds like that created major challenges for the industry, and it really made it hard to attract people here if there wasn't that potential promise of a pathway to permanent residency. And so I had heard some things about practices that businesses were putting in place to try to attract more people into the industry and to keep them, through more training, through more flexible working arrangements in terms of hours that weren't so long and demanding, perhaps. I mean, the pay issue. And of course, pay is not everything, and enthusiasm for the work is a big issue that attracts certainly me and pretty much everyone I know to their particular lines of work. But it has been striking that hospitality, that if we look at, there's a conversation that's been happening in Australia around the low rate of wages growth in recent years. And just this morning I was looking at some of the trends in recent years, and the low wage growth has been especially low in hospitality. And I think that's something that, pay isn't the only solution to getting more people into the industry and keeping them, but I think it is part of the solution. So one of the things that can drive pay up is by having a collectively bargained enterprise agreement with staff. And that's something that I think could be used more widely in hospitality. Businesses sitting down with their workforces and looking at ways to organise work better and to create the conditions that are going to keep people in the industry and in businesses once they're there. That's a practice that's been used in other industries and other countries that's proven pretty effectively for keeping staff committed and attracting them into businesses.
It's a tricky one when you're looking at a temporary workforce, though, isn't it? It's people that are residents in a country are much more likely to feel like they've got a stake in it, know their rights, and, you know, consider organising and fighting for better pay and conditions collectively. It's hard to imagine a student who feels like they're just going to be here for 2 years and they're a bit disposable and Australia really just wants them for their fees, to then look at, you know, changing the labour market.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. And I mean, that it's an idealistic solution, but, you know, it was part of the solution, the package of solutions that existed in that period from the 70s until the 90s, you know, when we had an immigration system that was very inclusive, but also a system of employment regulation that was also very inclusive. And I think that those solutions they're still relevant today. They're not things of the past, and they are. Just this week in New Zealand, the government there has mandated a shift back towards industry-wide bargaining agreements, precisely to try to, as a way of addressing employers' staffing needs, also increasing productivity in businesses. Because there's a whole body of research indicating if people are included and do feel like they're being treated properly at work, then they're more likely to be happy and satisfied, and they're more likely to be productive. There are solutions that are being used in other parts of the world, and I think that they're relevant to Australia. They might not resonate much under this government, but that's not to say that there won't be future ministers or future governments that aren't open to these ideas.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, another piece of that puzzle has to be prices, like how much diners are willing to pay for food. I think that downward pressure I think students unwittingly become part of this ecosystem of working in cheap restaurants for no money and serving cheap food to people who then think that's how much food should cost. So I think, I suppose that's one of those if you just start joining all the dots and you start to see, all these different elements that are problematic. But I think when I just have sitting on my shoulder a restaurant owner who's listening to this conversation and screaming, I can't charge more for my food. And, you know, so that is definitely part of it. And it's on all of us, I suppose, if we want to live in a society that's more equitable, you know, everybody's got to come to the table and realise that you can't just kick the can down the road. It has an impact at some point.
No, absolutely. I completely agree with you. And there needs to be a great understanding of the value and of what we're eating, and ensuring that people are prepared to pay according to that value. And I know that I know many restaurant owners who are wonderful people. And I remember a few years ago talking about some of my research about the hospitality industry, and a friend of mine who owns a restaurant in my local area, saying, look, I want to be able to pay staff better, and I do what I can, but it's so hard because I fully realise that it's an incredibly difficult industry to make ends meet in as a business owner. So I think that means that consumers absolutely need to play a more responsible role in ensuring that that they are willing to pay to ensure that businesses are supported and that staff are supported too.
Well, Chris, we are all implicated. We all love eating out, and some of us are those people who bring us those beautiful restaurant experiences. This has been a really great conversation. I'm so grateful to you for your time and all the insights that you bring as a result of the great work that you do in this area. Thank you so much for coming along and having a chat on Dirty Linen today.
Anytime, Danny. Thanks so much for the opportunity. I'm really thrilled to have had this conversation with you. So thanks.
Thank you. This is Dirty Linen, and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about. We spend a week thrashing around each issue, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta at Dirty Linen Podcast. We can't wait to hear from you.
this.